Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, March 31st, 2024, is by Mason Wiley on the topic of What Do You Know?
So do any of you know at what age a person reaches their maximum intelligence? For me, I remember being positive I had reached it at age 13. I remember that was the time when I was convinced that I had everything pretty much figured out and knew all the answers worth knowing and had praise heaped on me by parents and teachers. But surprise, surprise, it turns out that 13-year-old me was wrong. I've actually learned a ton in the almost half century since, and I've acquired knowledge of things my precocious punk self had no idea even existed. Through the experience of a lifetime, I've learned to shed certainty. I began to question things I thought I knew and opened myself to the possibility that maybe I did not know for sure. In short, I learned to have an open mind. Today, I'd like to relate my own personal journey from know-it-allism to self-skepticism. And some portion of it will no doubt be specific to me, but I think that the lessons that I learned are pretty universal to all of us. So, as is true, probably true for most Unitarian Universalists, I was a smart kid. Good grades came easy, but that alone didn't make me the know-it-all that I was. I had an intellectual University of Chicago-trained father, and he had an answer for everything. I do think that, you know, most times he was pretty correct, but it was years later when I was a young adult that my mother revealed the shocking truth. If my father did not have the actual answer, he would make one up. And he was really good at it, too. Probably because of his whip-smart delivery, whatever he said always sounded convincingly plausible, and I believed him. It wasn't until I was much older that I began to wonder, why did my father always have to have an answer for everything, and why did he always have to appear right? My conclusion was that he was in some way emotionally stuck at age 13, but that's a topic for therapy, not church. My grandmother, too, always used to throw out some allegedly factual tidbit, preceded by, they say. When I got older, I would ask her, who said? Who is they, Grandma? And of course, she couldn't answer, you know. But my takeaway was that she was just parroting things she heard without any memory of where she heard it or how credible the source was and stating it as fact. So my father and my grandmother first started chipping away at my bulwark of certitude. But my next big revelation came from a college class in the history of science. Like a lot of kids in my era who grew up with NASA moon launches and sci-fi movies and all that, I had a near religious belief in the certainty of scientific knowledge. Until I learned throughout human history, prevailing scientific wisdom and the worldview kept getting overthrown. The Earth was flat until people suddenly realized it was round. Of course, the sun revolved around the Earth until, we figured out the Earth revolves around the sun. And don't even get me started on quantum mechanics because I can't even explain that one. So, by extension, from that class, I surmise that today's scientific orthodoxy will undoubtedly be overthrown by some new earth-shattering revelation. And that pretty much ended my worshiping at the idol of scientific certainty. There came a couple of decades where I really didn't think about this stuff so much. Changing poopy diapers and worrying about finances has a way of curtailing philosophizing. But when my kids got older and started asking me questions and expecting answers, I could feel myself turning into my father. And I was like, whoa, wait a sec. I caught myself saying things I didn't necessarily know to be true. And once that revelation came, I started noticing it in myself more and more. I mean, I may as well have been saying they say in front of my things that was coming out of my mouth. And then I discovered a podcast called You're Not So Smart. And I don't know even know if it's on anymore. But on that podcast, they talked about an experiment from the 1970s that really created a eureka moment for me. And I'm going to, just so you know that I'm not making stuff up, I'm going to read you a summary of the experiment that I grabbed on the internet. And this is the mouth. I'm going to go slow because there's some heavy stuff here. In the mid-1970s, Timothy Wilson with Richard Nisbet conducted one of the best-known social psychology experiments of all time. It was a strikingly simple and involved asking subjects to assess the quality of hosiery. Subjects were asked at a bargain store to judge which one of four nylon stocking pantyhose was the best quality. The subjects were not told that the stockings were all, in fact, identical. Wilson and Nisbet presented the stockings to the subjects hanging on racks spaced equal distances apart. As situation would have it, the position of the stockings had a significant effect on the subject's quality judgments. In particular, moving from left to right, 12% of the subjects judged the first stockings as being the best quality. 17% of the subjects chose the second pair, 31% chose the third pair, and 40% chose the fourth, which were the most recently viewed stockings. When asked about their respective judgments, most of the subjects attributed their decision to the knit, weave, sheerness, elasticity, or workmanship of the stockings that they chose to be of best quality. Dispositional qualities of the stocking, if you will. Subjects provided a total of 80 different reasons for their choices. Now remember, these are all identical stockings. Not one, however, mentioned the position of the stockings or the relative recency with which the pairs were viewed. None, that is, saw the situation. In fact, when asked whether the position of the stockings could have influenced their judgments, only one subject admitted that position could have been influential. Wilson and Nisbet conclude that what matters is not why the position effect occurs, but that it occurs and that subjects do not report it or recognize it even when pointed out to them. So for me, there were a couple of big takeaways from this experiment. One, our decision-making is often affected by cognitive biases that we are not at all aware of. In this case of the stockings experiment, sequential bias and recency bias played a huge role in people's choices. But my second takeaway, and I think an even bigger one, is that when we are asked to explain our decisions or actions in a situation, we all too readily and easily are able to make up a story that has little to no bearing in reality, which I think is kind of the human condition. It's our reliance on story to make sense of reality and even our own sense of self is a gigantic and hugely interesting topic, but that's like a whole other day. But the fact that we often just make up a plausible sounding story to explain our actions, I think is a major blow to the idea that we are rationally acting creatures, weighing inputs and making a logical decision based on them. Throw in all this cognitive bias stuff, and it sounds a lot like we do things without conscious knowledge why. And we give animals a bad rap for being subject to instinct. Could it be that we are no better? Do we really have free will? In the full spirit of uncertainty, I don't actually have any answers to those questions. But I suspect that the dividing line between humans and animals may not be so great as has generally been believed. So at the time, which wasn't that I, was exposed to this experiment, it introduced cognitive biases to me. I hadn't really heard of it before. So I did what any good modern person would do. I Wikipedia-ed it. And oh my God, we have so many cognitive biases. First, let's define what is a cognitive bias is. And according to that ultimate arbiter, of all truth, Wikipedia, a cognitive bias is a systematic pattern of deviation from norm or rationality in judgment. Individuals create their own subjective reality from their perception of the input. An individual's construction of reality, not the objective input, may dictate their behavior in the world. Thus, cognitive biases may sometimes lead to perceptual distortion, inaccurate judgment illogical interpretation and irrationality. Wait a minute. Perceptual distortion, inaccurate judgment, illogical interpretation, and irrationality. That can't be me, can it? Yes, it can. In fact, we are all cognitively biased. Why do we have these cognitive biases? I mean, there are a number of reasons, and it's pretty complicated, but just a top line, some cognitive biases exist for adaptive reasons, like it's how we can screen out certain inputs from our reality so we can focus on the lion hunting us. Some cognitive biases exist merely because the way our brains are wired and we process information. A lot of cognitive biases are based on our necessarily limited perspective, you know, because we're always seeing the world from ourselves. Some exist based on our kind of propensity to protect our sense of self, and I'm sure there are a bunch of other reasons, but those are the big ones. So this idea that our rationality is a big part of what makes us such unique creatures may need to be tempered a bit, because it seems we are often not so rational. And here we go. I printed, if anyone wants to see, I printed out a list of cognitive biases from Wikipedia. And there's a lot, you know, and there's a lot, I don't know how many pages are here, but there, you know, I'll leave it up here. There are 19 major groups and over 200 individually recognized cognitive biases. And it's always evolving. You know, they've been doing research on this over the past 60 years, and I think they take some away, they add new ones. If you think you are immune, then you probably are just suffering from bias blind spot, a form of egocentric bias that is the tendency to see oneself as less biased than other people. Another is false uniqueness bias, the tendency of people to see their projects and themselves as more singular than they actually are. So apparently my mom was wrong and I am not uniquely destined by fate to be singularly amazing. What a letdown. Here's a timely one, backfire bias. It's one you probably recognize in our country today. The tendency to react to disconfirming evidence by strengthening one's previous beliefs. Take that, Marguerite. And last one, for anyone who's ever played armchair psychologist to explain the actions of others, which I think is basically everyone, there's fundamental attribution error, which is the tendency to overemphasize personality-based explanations for behaviors observed in others and underemphasize the role and power of situational influences on the same behavior. Just one sec. In fact, when my wife and I went to couples therapy, which did not work out, by the way, because she's my ex-wife, the therapist had us read a book by the Harvard Negotiation Project titled Difficult Conversations. Great book, by the way, if you ever, it's thin. At least that book is still with me, even if my wife is not. But one of the things that in that book, a big point is that we should not pass motivations or pass judgment on the motivations of others. We shouldn't say, you're only doing that because we don't even accurately recognize our own motivations for our actions, let alone are qualified to accurately know the motivations for others, so that stay away from motivations. What's my point for all of this? Is it to say the pursuit of knowledge is meaningless? That's not my conclusion. I still enjoy learning, but I do try to be more conscious that things may not be as they seem to me to be, and that I may not have all the answers. No matter how much I think I know, there is always more to learn. And if I seem super convinced about something, I should maybe take that as a warning signal that I should think about questioning it. This idea that we can find safety in a wall of unassailable logic is a very Western idea. Easterners don't really have that same faith in logic. That's why Zen Buddhists created koans, which you probably know. You know, those are those unanswerable questions like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? They were, you know, they're intentionally unanswerable to show that ultimate enlightenment could not be achieved through pure rationality. Same with the Tao Te Ching, which we read from. The Tao that can be stated is not the eternal Tao, because ultimate truth lies beyond the limitations of cognitively based, biased human thought. So my personal prescription that I try to follow is to be open to the answer being bigger than I think, try to be intellectually humble, and keep an open mind. That doesn't mean that I don't catch myself starting to state something as a matter of fact, but catching myself and, wait a minute, I don't really know. Or, as Benjamin Franklin said, the doorstep to the temple of wisdom is a knowledge of our own ignorance. Knowledge of our own ignorance is just the doorstep. You know, to get inside the temple, you need to realize how much more you need to learn. So I will just end on, remember, there are no such thing as stupid questions, only stupid answers. The end.